call number 02-24-252-CB, Jim Burgess versus City of Westworth Village. May it please the court, Chad Baruch will argue for appellant, and Dan Tobin will argue for athlete.
All right, you may proceed, Mr. Baruch.
Thank you, and may it please the court. The city's taking fails under 2206-001 unless it falls within the exemption for a public park. Admittedly, we do not have a silver bullet as to what the meaning of park under the eminent domain statute is, but there are an awful lot of indicators that seem to suggest it isn't this golf facility. I want to start, actually, by clarifying the facility we're talking about, because I did a poor job of it in the briefs. I referred to it in the briefs as a golf course, and that is inaccurate. The city accurately described it in its brief, page 3 of its brief. It is, the property being taken by my client, Mr. Burgess, will be used for a short game practice area. That's what we're talking about, not a golf course. That just doesn't sound like a park, a short game practice area. Now, we don't believe this court, to decide this case, has to define for time immemorial and posterity the exact line of demarcation between a park and a golf facility.
Would a practice area next to a soccer field at a park, would that be part of a park because it's a practice area?
Might be. I think once you establish the nature of a park, I think there's a long line of cases that say you can put a lot of different things in a park without divesting it of its character. But that's not, of course, what we have here. And that's sort of, I think, my opening point, is that you don't have to define that precise line for every future type of facility in every future context. As our former Chief Justice liked to say, context matters, right? But I think you can say with confidence that this particular short game practice area is not a public park. Future case might be different, but this one isn't. And in our view, the single most important indicator of that is section 251.001 of the local government code. That's the statute that defines a municipality's power of eminent domain. Now remember, in KMS Retail, the Texas Supreme Court told us we're supposed to be hunting for statutes that cover the same subject matter and have the same general purpose. And that is exactly what 251.001 does. It is the eminent domain statute, and it refers separately. It empowers a municipality to exercise the power of eminent domain for a park or a recreational facility. It refers to them separately. And we think that's very, very important. They're two different things. And remember, the legislature easily could have just cut and pasted that language over into the statutory exemption in 2206-001. That statute had been on the books since the 1980s, but they didn't. They pulled over the reference to parks and left the reference to recreational facilities sitting in the local government code. They did not incorporate it into the statutory exemption. I know the panel is well aware of the rules of statutory construction. We don't just presume that the words are used intentionally, we also presume they're omitted intentionally. So this intentional omission is important in our view. And I'll return to it in a few minutes when I talk about the Tort Claims Act cases cited by the city. I think the dictionary definitions reinforce it as well. Now, obviously, there are thousands of dictionary definitions out there, and any given source will give you probably a dozen, depending, again, on context. But they all, sort of the penumbra of these definitions, seem to entail three things when it comes to a public park. One is the idea of some sort of open natural space, however big or small it may be, an open natural space. The second is the idea of its use. Almost all the definitions use the same phrase, rest and recreation. The city wants to focus in on that recreation part, but they say rest and recreation. And third, the idea, as Justice Wallach points out, that there may be multiple uses in a park. There's lots of things you can do in a park. And I think that comports with our common everyday understanding when someone talks about taking the kids to the park. We might think about, for example, frisbee games. But we might think about families picnicking, children playing tag. There might be a small playground. Lots of different uses. And people resting as well. People go to the park to enjoy their sack lunch on a nice day. They may sit and read the newspaper on a nice day. Some people may even nap on a park bench. So lots of uses, open natural space, and rest and recreation.
But if you had a city soccer field, I mean, not a lot of resting going on in soccer, I would say, but it's clearly recreation.
And that's absolutely correct. It's a recreational facility. And I guess I didn't wrap up my point about 250.001 of the local government code. If a park and a recreational facility are different, and we are required to presume they are because the legislature has referenced them separately, which one of those does a short game practice area fall under? Is it more a park or is it more a recreational facility? So in our view, Justice Kerr, if you had a soccer field in a park, you would still have a park. But if all you go out to build is a soccer field, that seems like a recreational facility. It seems very hard to say, no, a putting area, that's not a recreational facility, that's a public park. I don't think most of us would come to that conclusion just under our common, ordinary understanding. And in our view, if it is solely a recreational facility, the statute suggests that is something different than a public park. Again, the legislature could have used that identical language. They could have literally cut and pasted it out of the eminent domain statute into 2206, and they didn't. They intentionally left off a portion of it.
I may be asking this question only because there's a whole bunch of students present, and I'm thinking about questions that they might have, but does it not matter, or does it matter if the public is having to pay to be there? I mean, at the end of the day,
I don't think it's dispositive because I think it might matter to the sort of overall calculus. But there are definitely our parks that the public pays to access. For example, some of the nature parks on lakes and trails, you might pay a $10 entrance fee, and I don't think that would necessarily mean it wasn't a park. At the same time, I think your point is well taken. It would be one factor, and again, context matters. And it does seem a little different that you have to pay to get into this facility and pay to use this facility as opposed to going to the public park on a sunny day to sit and eat your lunch. So,
and pay to a private park.
To a private entity, that's
as
exactly right.
As opposed to a government or even a quasi-governmental body.
Correct.
That's a factor.
Yes, I think those are all factors. Again, and as I say, I'm trying to be honest and say I don't have that magic silver bullet, but what we just seem to have is just all of these, it's almost like an argument of death by a thousand cuts. We just all these factors seem to be pointing in the same direction. Now, the city offers really only three arguments in response to this. The first is to point to the Texas Supreme Court's recent decisions in City of Austin v. Whittington and the KMS retail case, which is my Sprouts grocery store in my suburb in Dallas. And I don't think either of those really have much to do with the inquiry before this court today. City of Austin said that a public parking garage that services the public convention center is a public building. That seems pretty straightforward. I can't see how that possibly bears on the issue of whether a short game practice area is a public park. Now, a couple things about that, though. Number one, to Justice Walker's point, the Supreme Court made a point of emphasizing in that decision that the money was going directly to the city. It wasn't going to a private entity. They noted that the city itself was going to operate that parking garage and that the patrons who paid would be paying their money directly to the City of Austin. And that was important in the analysis. Distinguishing fact here, because we don't have that. Here, the money's going to a private entity. The second thing that's important is that even the city, to make this argument, what they're trying to do is say, well, because that's a public building, this is a public park, because it's open to members of the public. What legal authority are they pointing to for that argument? 251.001 of the local government's code. The same statute I was just telling you about that differentiates between public parks and recreational facilities. Now, KMS retail, that has even less to do with this. That was a case, and I will tell you I briefed this. I missed this in the briefing, so it's important to emphasize. If you look at page 182, the coverage of the exemption in that case actually was undisputed. Nobody was arguing. It was a public street in Rowlett leading to a Sprouts grocery store, and there's a separate exemption for public roads. And neither party disputed that it fell into that exemption. What they disputed, the property owner was trying to take the position that the Supreme Court should judicially engraft a sort of good faith requirement onto the statute, and the Supreme Court said, yeah, we're not doing that. It says public roads, this is a public road, we're done.
Let me ask a question. I'm kind of want to jump ahead a little bit to the constitutional issue. But the constitutional amendments didn't provide a procedure for addressing the question of whether or not a taking is a the primary purpose of economic development or enhancement of tax revenues. When they created the amendments to the eminent domain statute, they said, okay, for these portions, you can have the assumption, the deference, but for these, you don't. So how do you resolve the difference between the fact that the legislature created these different use of the legislative deferral rule for certain portions of the eminent domain under the statute, but didn't address that in the constitutional amendments?
So, yes, and it's confusing. I think that's the first answer, is it created some confusion. 2206 is plainly much stricter than the constitutional amendments. And to be clear, we are not making any constitutional claim in front of this court. And the reason for that, of course, is we can't, because the governing deference standard prevents us from making that claim. So we don't, the only constitutional claim we're making is the one that we're preserving in the event we ever end up in Austin.
Well, what Justice Blacklock argued and what the majority seemed to be saying was, you know, the constitutional amendments are the basis for a change of the deference standard. And so what I'm trying to figure out is how you reconcile the differences between the constitutional issue. And so in other words, if you go to the constitutional question, how do you reconcile those differences?
So in the context of the claim we're bringing, one, the constitutional changes have no bearing on it, and here's why. Because we're not challenging the public use element. We're challenging the statutory element on conferring a benefit on a private entity. So the whole public use inquiry, which is what all of that discussion is about, has no bearing on that prong. Now, there are other prongs it might have a bearing on, but the statute simply says if you confer a benefit on a private entity through use of the property, it's prohibited. So that's the only claim we're bringing before this court.
Well, and isn't that more restrictive than the Constitution?
By far. Absolutely and by far. And the timing kind of supports that. The court probably knows this, but the statute was enacted roughly 3.5 seconds after the Kelo decision. I mean, that decision came down and the legislature could not. The constitutional changes took quite a bit of time. It was like 3 or 4 years later. And that original statutory change, yes, is much more restrictive of the government's power of eminent domain. So,
and that was just the product of the ratification process.
Yes. I think that's right. But there is, as the panel points out, there are very different, you know, there's very strong differences between the statutory prohibition and the constitutional prohibition. The legislature, for whatever reason, was much stricter than the voters were. A couple of things I better hit here because I'm running out of time. The first, and I'm not going to belabor the point, but I think the Tort Claims Act cases, as the court kind of discussed in KMS Retail, that's a different question. You know, governmental versus proprietary functions and when we're going to permit waiver, that has nothing to do with the government's power to seize private property. I mean, we have a pretty strong tradition in Texas of protecting private property rights, and so what we do with eminent domain does not necessarily have anything to do with what we do under the Tort Claims Act. But I will point out this interesting tidbit about the Tort Claims Act. It, too, separates parks and recreational facilities as two different things. In fact, it doesn't even group them together. It has parks and zoos in one clause, and then it refers to recreational facilities in a separate clause. So again, consistently, the legislature seems to be telling us that a public park is something different from a public recreational facility. And again, a short game practice area seems much more like a recreational facility than it does a park. Final point, and I don't think it's terribly important, but the associated words canon, I don't expect the court to go deep down an interpretive canon path, but we think they're applying the wrong canon here. The canon that should apply here is the negative implication canon, or as we learned it in law school before all of these people were alive, the expressio unis rule of interpretation. The inclusion of one thing implies the exclusion of all others. And here we know The legislature knew how to say parks and recreational facilities, and they chose to say only one of them. So in our view, it is the negative implication canon that would shed the most light on the meaning of the statute and exclude the city's taking of this short game practice area recreational facilities. If there are no questions, I'll cede my last 8 seconds. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Tobin.
Hey, may it please the court. Good afternoon, justices. My name is Dan Tobin, and my firm represents the city of Westworth Village in this case. I'm going to respectfully disagree with counsel on 2 points. A, that there's no silver bullet for the meaning of park, and B, that KMS retail did not involve the interpretation of any of the statutory terms in 2206. There is a silver bullet for the definition of park. It dates back 100 years to the Texas Supreme Court's decision in Lewis versus City of Fort Worth. At issue in that case was whether the City of Fort Worth could use bond funds allocated for a park for buildings for shows, rodeos, fairs, expeditions, and other amusements. The Texas Supreme Court concluded, generally speaking, the term park now has a very broad meaning. This is especially true as applied to municipal parks. We now understand a municipal park to be a place where the public generally may go for various kinds of recreation and amusement.
What would you concede? It sounds like the word has gotten more restrictive, more specific over the past 100 years. I mean, if you take in consideration the fact that there is this intentional exclusion, or at least an exclusion, when the statute was ratified, that recreational facilities were left out.
We would argue, say back to that, Your Honor, that recreational facilities is included in park. They did not need to include it. Just like they generally refer to park buildings and they refer to hospitals, they did not take 2501 in its entirety for any of these public uses. So it shouldn't be discriminatory or prejudicial against parks. It should be noted that provision, recreational facility, they don't take the entire 2501. So based on the 100 years of Texas case law establishing that parks has a broad meaning, includes recreational facilities, there's not one case over the last 100 years that's limited the definition of park. In fact, it continues to expand. Horseback riding, golf courses, and in fact, even a zoo in 1928. And as this court is aware, we need to avoid an absurd result from any definition of park. With this dated definition proposed by the landowner, a zoo would not be included in a park. Baseball fields would not be included in a park. So if the Texas Rangers wanted to partner with the City of Fort Worth to build a baseball complex, the Texas Rangers could not do that under this definition of park. If the City of Fort Worth wanted to expand its beautiful zoo with a private partnership and a sponsorship, it could not do that because parks is given a very narrow definition as proposed by the landowner. And that's where KMS retail comes in. They were asked, the Texas Supreme Court was asked to define public road. And this is on page 187. And the Supreme Court said, nor do we find the intent in section 2206.001 for the meaning of public road to vary according to standards set by local government and governmental entities. For purposes of subsection C, the exception section under which park falls, public road has one common ordinary meaning. In Texas, park has one common ordinary meaning. 1936, the Texas Supreme Court found that it's a very broad definition, especially as applied to municipal courts or municipal parks. That was affirmed in 1960 in the State versus Merrill case by the Texas Supreme Court. At issue was whether horseback riding fit within the definition of park. It is a matter of common knowledge that parks are used by the public generally for recreation through different games such as tennis, pitching, horseshoes, croquet, baseball, golf, walking, horseback riding, picnicking, and general outdoor exercise. That definition has maintained since 1960. We cite many cases where that opinion, the parks is interpreted to be broad. And again, there's just not one example of a definition of parks being restricted to what the landowner is proposing in this case.
Well, I mean, you would, I would assume you would concede that just because it's, it may be broad, it still has its limitations. I mean, you couldn't, the city couldn't take somebody's private property, compensate them, then allow McDonald's to build a McDonald's on that piece of property, and then just put a little bit of green around it and say this is a park, could they? I mean, there are limitations to this. You would concede that. It's not just because we're supposed to interpret it in a broad way. I mean, that doesn't mean everything ultimately falls under the umbrella of a park.
You're right. I would concede that, and I would point the court to Webb versus City of Dallas. It's a Northern District of Federal Northern District of Texas opinion from 2001. It's not cited in our brief, but it is an opinion where if you're familiar with tennis and golf course, the Tennyson family originally, the heirs were now the Webb family. They donated the land to the City of Dallas that became Tennyson Golf Course. Tennyson, the City of Dallas decided we want to develop Tennyson Golf Course and make it, you know, more into two courses, higher level golf course to attract more people to play golf. And the family challenged that. And they said, you know, this is no longer a park purpose. The federal district court rejected that, relying on the line of cases I just discussed, that just because they're leasing it for golf purposes, it still maintains its park status. So the McDonald's example is pretty extreme, but you're right. That would be a loophole that a court would have to be wary of, but here we don't have that. We have, and I would note that when the amendments were passed, the 2009 amendment was passed and the 2206 act was enacted, the Texas legislature was aware that cities get into complicated relationships and leases with land they condemn. If you look at our brief, we talk about the legislative history leading up to the constitutional amendment. And Senator Robert Duncan explained that the three words we used, ownership, use, and enjoyment, would contemplate, and it was the intent of the negotiation to ensure that a condemning authority could own the property, could use it, could lease it, and could enjoy the financial benefits of that property. And I think that's an appropriate use. It is consistent with the uses that are going on with property that is taken by eminent domain today. So that's why we negotiated. Further, go ahead, Justice Kerr, I'm sorry.
While I'm thinking about it, you said that the Webb case wasn't in your briefing. Do you have a citation for it?
Yes, ma'am. US DIST Lexus 16054, Webb versus City of Dallas.
You know, we only use Westlaw up here. Do you happen to have a parallel Westlaw citation for us?
I don't. I'm sorry.
The state doesn't allow us to pay for two premium subscriptions.
I apologize. I don't have the Westlaw site for that, Your Honor.
I'd kind of like to follow up on Justice Walker's line of questioning, which was the concept of public use. Under the Texas Constitution, and the language you were just talking about, public use has to be for the ownership, use, and enjoyment of the property. But the exception to that is that public use does not include the taking of property under subsection A for transfer to a private entity for the primary purpose of economic development or enhancement of tax revenues, right? So if a governmental entity is condemning a person's property to then turn around and execute a long-term lease on that property, isn't that for the purpose of transferring private property to another private entity? And the question is whether it's for the primary purpose of economic development or enhancement, and if it is, then that's not public use, correct?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. You know, transfer, is that a conveyance by deed, or does that include leases?
Well, it's a broad term, isn't it?
Well, if you look at the legislative history we cite, both the House and the Senate, in passing the amendment, took out occupy, that the public had to occupy the premises, mm-hmm. because they wanted to maintain the ability of condemning authorities to lease property.
And leasing, it's one thing, but the purpose, the primary purpose of the transfer is the determinative question, isn't it?
If you're not transferring it, conveying it by deed, then I don't think the second provision is triggered.
Well, it says transfer, okay, and the first thing we look to is the language of the legislation or the constitutional provision itself, correct? Before we ever go back into looking at constitution, what happened in the legislature in terms of the history, right? And transfer is a broad term. You can transfer a property. You can sell it outright, correct?
Yes, sir.
You can sell it with various limitations on the types of the conveyance, correct? You can issue, you can lease it, you can license it. There are a lot of ways to transfer the property, but that's not defined here, is it?
It is not.
Okay, so.
We still own the property. We did transfer a stick in the bundle.
Well, you transferred a property right. A lease is a property interest in the property, right? As opposed to a license, which is just permission to use it, correct? I mean, property law creates various gradations of property interest, right?
Right.
Okay. So what I'm getting at is if you're going to transfer, let's talk about a lease, and the city is going to lease the property that it's condemning, and the primary purpose is for economic development, then that's not public use, right?
Again, I think there's a lot to unpack there. I would respectfully disagree that transfer includes leasing. We know that the amendment was passed in response to Kelo. Kelo did not involve a lease. It involved a conveyance of deed, a fee simple. We know that the Texas legislature, in passing the amendment, wanted to maintain condemning authorities' ability to lease property. So I don't agree that it includes transfer.
But the question is not whether they can lease it. The question is, what's the primary purpose for it? If their primary purpose is for, we're going to lease this green space, and we're going to lease it to Greenpeace so that they can preserve it in a nice green area, that's different from transferring it to XYZ Entertainment Company so they can build an entertainment park, isn't it?
I understand that. Yes, I'm not disagreeing that a court could interpret transfer to include lease.
So where I'm going here is in your proof in the trial court. What proof of the primary purpose did you have before the trial court for the court to address what the primary purpose was?
Again, what proof did we have in the trial court? We had all of the legislative resolutions from our client.
Well, the legislative resolutions talked about a public use for a public purpose. They didn't talk about primary purpose, did they?
No, but they couldn't have any. Sorry.
I'm sorry. So how can you have a declaration of a primary purpose if you don't say it's a primary purpose?
Well, I think that a municipal golf course under 25, the local government code 25001 is enumerated to be a public use. This is a municipal golf course.
I'm not talking about use. I'm talking about purpose. There's a difference between the use of public use.
Right. And I would maintain that we introduced evidence at trial. This is an existing municipal golf course. This is not a brand new use. This is a property that sits between the 12th and the 18th holes.
I'm not talking about the use of the property.
I know. I'm explaining the purpose of why they took the property. It's a donut hole that sits between the 12th and the 18th hole.
I've seen the pictures, yes.
Yeah, so that was the purpose. They were trying to unify their golf course and expand their golf course by acquiring property that sat right in between the 12th and the 18th
hole. As part of an overall transaction, to then turn around and lease it to a private entity. And so my question is, your resolutions go to the eminent domain exercise, but it doesn't address what you're doing with it when you're turning around and transferring it to somebody else, right?
I'm sorry, I'm not following the question.
Would you agree that there's no evidence in the trial court about what the primary purpose of this transfer to the private entity was?
No, I don't agree.
Okay, what was the evidence of the
purpose? Evidence is that they need this private-public partnership to expand the golf course.
I'm not talking about, what was the purpose? Was this done? All right, go ahead.
Well, I don't think the city could have built a new clubhouse without this private-public partnership. Just like in Winnington, the city partnered with.
Well, your resolution 2022-01 says to serve existing and future development in the city, not in the golf course, in the city.
And I think our briefing, first of all, the landowner is not challenging this on appeal. So I guess if I'm not ready to answer all your questions, that's why. This is not a question that's on appeal. The landowner said during his opening remarks that they're not arguing this. Secondly, we did address this in our briefing.
Well, they did preserve it for review based upon the dissent by Chief Justice Blacklock and two other justices, and probably a fourth one in another opinion since then. So about whether or not the...
I can talk about whether or not judicial deference should apply.
Okay.
And before you do that, though, let me just point a clarification. The city actually executed the lease with this private entity before the takings proceedings began, correct? It was actually already secured. The lease was already secured.
I believe that is correct, Your Justice, yes.
And I does that matter, I think? And I understand this is not a point you were prepared to talk about, and you're about to talk about the deference piece, but that would matter, wouldn't it, at least in this line of questioning that Justice Wallach has at least begun with you.
Or did the lease include some sort of proviso, if we can't get this land, then all bets are off?
The lease did include that. It said if they can't, the Underpart Life was charged with going out and acquiring this property.
It has a contingency clause.
And they weren't able to do that. And that's common. That's what happened in KMS Retail, and that's what happened in the city of Austin versus Winnington.
And I guess the reason I bring that up is it's kind of hard to argue that it's not a primary purpose if you already have a lease secured and there's a contingency clause in it that says essentially that if this doesn't work, the lease is off.
No, the primary purpose being economic development?
Yes, correct.
Well, that I don't think that goes to the primary purpose being economic development at all. It goes to they were engaging a private entity, a private-public partnership with Winnington and KMS Retail, both said is permissible under the new laws to make this expansion happen. The primary purpose of this taking was to expand the golf course because this property sat right in the middle of it. The economic development benefits, while there, were secondary, as our brief kind of outlines, and what economic development, the case law on economic development and why it wasn't the primary purpose here.
Well, didn't the lease say the purpose of the lease was for commercial purposes?
Yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, nobody's disputing that Underpart Life was going to make money and that there was going to be a commercial element to this, just like they explain in the legislative history behind this. They are aware that condemning authorities lease properties for such things as coffee shops. That is a commercial purpose that is permissible before Kelo, is permissible after Kelo. Just because the private entity is making some money doesn't make it not a public use or primarily only for economic development.
And you would concede that the private entity in this case, they had entered in negotiations with Burgess to purchase that property, and it wasn't until those negotiations fell apart that they then executed this lease with Westworth Village.
Right, and that occurred in both KMS Retail and City of Austin versus Winnington. The Supreme Court said that is not a factor at all in determining public use. It is perfectly fine for a private entity. If they can't get it the first time through negotiations, if the condemning authority then comes in and says, okay, we'll have to condemn.
But neither case addressed Section 17B of the Constitution, correct?
The amendment.
It's the amendment to Article 6.
Well, KMS Retail challenges it on, yes, KMS Retail is an express challenge under 2206.
But they got stuck because they didn't ask for that. They didn't ask the Supreme Court to reconsider legislative deference, right?
Right, but we're kind of conflating some different issues. And what I would point to on the legislative deference, because my time is running out, is the Supreme Court, or I'm sorry, the Texas legislature in the first version of the bill of the 2009 constitutional amendment contained this language. We cite to the legislative history in our brief, but I'm going to read one that we didn't include. It originally stated the state or political subdivision that takes damage or destroys property must prove by clear and convincing evidence that the contemplated use of the property is public and necessary at the time the attempt is made to take damage and destroy the property. So the legislature expressly considered including a provision to change the judicial deference. They did not. They took that out because of the cost it would incur to local governments and TxDOT to condemn properties.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal.
May it please the court, just two very quick laser-focused points that I'd like to make. The first.
Well, let me cut you off. Because I want to go back to the parks and recreation. You know, your position is that they're separate. You heard council say that essentially it's a part of, it falls under the umbrella of, and I come back to it, I just, you know, it sounds like your position is essentially parks and recreation may make for a good TV show, but those two words don't really fall together in the state of Texas. They truly are, for the purposes of this area of jurisprudence, they should be considered separately.
That may overstate our position a little bit.
Okay.
So, and that's actually coincidentally exactly where I was going to start, I think. All of those old cases, including Lewis from 100 years ago, those weren't eminent domain cases, but those cases, what they say is that once you create a park, and the example I'm going to use is the park everybody knows the best, Central Park, right? Central Park was established as a public park, and no one could possibly dispute that. Over the years, they've put some boats on there, they put a skating rink in there, there's a John Lennon memorial, there may be tennis courts, you could put a museum and a library, you could do all that. And you could put a recreational, those are all recreational facilities. They could be part of a park. So I want to make that very plain. They don't change the park's character. Simply by dropping a tennis court in the middle of Central Park, you don't render it not a park. But that's not what we have here. We don't have a park that they are adding a putting facility to. They took this property to create a recreational facility. So again, context matters, and in this context, yes, it is a recreational facility, not a park. They could join in some contexts, but certainly not here, and the city isn't really arguing otherwise. They're not saying, well, we had a park sitting here first, and so that's plainly not the case. Second point I want to make is this. And again, not one of the city cannot cite a single case involving a park and the exercise of eminent domain. None of these cases they're talking about were eminent domain cases. Why is that so important? Again, because our history in Texas, we treat seizure of private property differently, my English teacher would tell me, than almost anything else. So it's one thing to say, as the cases do, yes, you can go raise money for all sorts of things in a park. And yes, you can go spend money on those things. And yes, you can issue bonds on those things. It's another thing to say you can seize a private property owner's property for a recreational facility.
Let me ask the same question you that I did to opposing counsel. What evidence in the record before the trial court was there as to the primary purpose for this transfer of the title or transfer of the interest to a private entity, the operator of the golf course? The only thing I saw on their side were the resolutions. They mentioned nothing about that, correct?
I think the answer is none.
Okay.
I mean, to my mind, the answer is none. At least direct evidence. I mean, I suppose perhaps there were some inferences that could have been drawn, but I don't think there was any. I'm unaware of any.
Next question is, primary purpose, that to me sounds like intent. It sounds like a fact issue. So if there's no evidence on one side of a fact issue, what do you do?
So my understanding of the law here, and this is why I said we were reserving that issue for us, my understanding is you've sort of got, you're being sent in two different directions here, because that language about primary purpose plainly says, it relates back to public use. It says, if that's your primary purpose, then that's not a public use. So, and by the way, I finally have caught up to where you were 20 minutes ago. I understand what you're asking
me. I'm sorry I wasn't clear.
No, I've got there now. But then we have this case law from the Texas Supreme Court that says, essentially, once the government says it's a public use, it's a public use. And I'm not really sure how we're to reconcile those, because one of them says the judicial branch must defer to their statement or determination of public use, but then we have this constitutional provision that says, yeah, but that ain't a public use. I'm not really sure how we're to resolve those, but in our view...
But you're not asking us to decide that.
Correct, and that's... You want our
betters down in Austin to take the first crack?
At first, I really thought it would be appropriate to ask that of this court, and after receiving the city's brief and reflecting on it further, yes, we think we probably have to take that issue to Austin.
But in a plea to the jurisdiction, evidence matters.
It does, absolutely. Or it can. Doesn't always, but it can. Yes, Your Honor. Any other questions? Or lack thereof, certainly. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Your case is submitted. The oral argument has been very helpful, and we appreciate y'all showing up here to answer our questions. And I hope that our students found it somewhat interesting. It's not like TV court dramas, of course, but I'm sure it was explained to you by Justice Womack exactly what it is we do here. And hope you found it enlightening. So with that, we will stand adjourned.